This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. We're going to talk about a couple things today. At the top of the list is going to be the function of bonds in a portfolio, how to evaluate them, what role do they play in a retirement plan, and why are they the largest asset class in the world today? So we're going to be talking about that. Also, we're going to be talking about tax-efficient business planning. You know, if you're listening to this program, it's April 15th and you're filing your tax returns. I know that probably didn't put you in a good mood. We're going to talk about maybe how to put you in a better mood by reducing those taxes through tax-efficient retirement plans. Everything from 401ks to defined benefit pension plans to SEP IRAs to simple IRAs to profit sharing plans. All of that coming up with my special guest, Tom Collette from The Standard.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kathleen Harris. Jim and I are talking about bonds this week because I had a couple of kind of interesting conversations with two different clients this week. I thought that would make a good case study for everyone listening out there, because I think if these clients are representative of a lot of folks that listen to us, I think that there's a lot of people out there who don't really understand what a bond really is, how it functions, how it's different from a stock, and how you essentially look at it in your portfolio. How do you evaluate it? Because bonds and stocks respond to different things. That's why they're an important part of your portfolio. But I thought, you know, Jim and I should just go over a few basics about bonds. So, Jim, you want to start with a couple of bond basics?
Why don't we start out with bond basics? I mean, when you're investing in a bond, essentially you're making a loan. You're making a loan either to the government, if you're buying a government bond, a loan to a corporation if you own corporate bonds, or to the state that you live in, or perhaps the city you live in if you're buying municipal bonds. If you think of a bond, think of your mortgage. Okay, so you have an asset called your home. Well, buying that home, a bank made a loan to you, enabling you to buy that home. It's the same thing when you buy a bond. You are a creditor. You are basically loaning money to either a government, a corporation, or some kind of state-type entity. And in exchange for that, you're going to get two things. Number one, you're going to get a stated interest rate. And there's various factors that go into play on that interest rate. Normally, it's a fixed interest rate. So let's make this simple. Let's just assume that, you know, you're loaning a corporation $10,000. It's a $10,000 bond that you're buying from them. The interest rate on the bond is 5%. So the corporation in this case agrees that every single year until the bond matures, they're going to pay you 5%. So in this case, on that $10,000 bond, you would be getting $500 of interest. In addition to that, that bond has a maturity date. It could be 1 year, it could be 5 years, it could be out to 20 or 30 years. I mean, think of your mortgage. Your mortgage is a 30-year mortgage, so it has a maturity date. And so we have the interest rate and we have the maturity date. And let's take that $10,000 bond. Let's assume that it matures in 10 years. It's paying you a 5% interest rate. So for the 10 years that you hold that bond, you're going to get $500 of interest every single year. And at the end of 10 years, the corporation is going to give you back your $10,000. Now, some bonds have a feature called their callable feature, which means that before that 10-year maturity, that corporation, or let's say even the government entity, can call the bond before it matures. And sometimes companies will do that because they think, well, interest rates are heading down, even though I'm paying you 5% now. In the next couple of years, if the Fed's lowering interest rates, maybe I can call that bond, pay you back, refinance that bond and get a lower interest rate. Think of the same thing that you might have done as a homeowner when interest rates have gone down on mortgages, as they have over the last couple of years. You may have gone out into the marketplace and refinanced your mortgage at a lower interest rate to save money. It's no different with bond investors. So some bonds have something called a callable feature, which allows them to retire that bond before its maturity date. Now, let's talk about interest rates. There's the coupon interest rate. That is when the bond is issued. Going back to our example, the 5% bond, the coupon rate is 5%. Now, there's something else called a current yield. Now, what happens if interest rates go up on a bond? What happens is, let's say interest rates go from 5% to 6%. Well, what would happen is nobody's going to want to buy your bond, which is paying 5%, if they can buy a new bond that's paying 6%. So let's say that the value of your bond drops in value from $10,000 to $9,000. Now, the corporation is still paying 5% on that original $10,000, but let's say you go in the marketplace and you buy that bond for $9,000, well, you're going to get that $500, and if you take $500, and since you didn't have to pay $10,000, the interest rate or the current yield is now 5.5%. It goes up because you didn't have to pay $10,000 to buy that same bond. You paid $9,000. So that's something we call in the bond market current yield. Now, bonds are always selling in the marketplace. They trade. They don't fluctuate as greatly as stocks do, unless we're in a very volatile interest rate market, as you saw, for example, with Greek bonds when they went through a crisis. But bonds either go for their par value, which is what they were issued at, a premium, and a premium comes into play if, let's say, that 5% bond, let's say interest rates drop to 4%. Now, let's say the value of your bond goes up 10%. Well, obviously, if somebody is going to buy a $10,000 bond, it's gone up 10%. They're going to have to pay $11,000 to get that same $500 income. So bonds are either selling at par or they're selling at premium, meaning interest rates have gone down, or they're selling at a discount, meaning that interest rates have gone down.
I think this is really interesting, Jim, because I did have a client who called in and told me he had hopped on to FINRA, which is one of our regulatory bodies, had hopped onto FINRA's website, gone on to their bond market tool, and pulled up municipal bonds in his area. And he told me he had found bonds that had coupon rates of 6-7%. And no doubt that product is out there. But because interest rates are so low, is a person going to be paying a premium or a discount for that bond, Jim? A premium, right?
Yeah, he's absolutely right. Let's take the $10,000 bond. Let's assume that that bond was issued, let's say, at the beginning of the last decade, where you could still get 5 or 6% on a tax-free bond if you went back to the years, let's say, 99 or 2000 or in 1995 when interest rates were much higher. I can remember getting 8% on treasuries in 1995 when the Fed was raising interest rates and you could have got 6%. But today, given that the municipal bond market is probably closer to 3%, chances are that $10,000 bond that's paying 6 or 7%, he might be paying $12,000 or $11,500. He may be paying $1,500 to $2,000 premium over the par value of the bond. And I might point out that if, let's say it was going back, and let's just keep it simple, let's say there's 10 years left of maturity in that bond, Kathleen, he's getting 6 and 7% on the $10,000, not on the $12,000 that he paid. So his current yield is not going to be 6 or 7%. It's going to be much lower than that. And if he holds the bond to maturity, the bond is only going to pay him $10,000.
So he's essentially locked in a $2,000 principal loss to get that higher monthly or quarterly income from the bond. So he's locked in a loss.
He's locked in the loss. Now, he may get a current yield that's slightly higher above the regular yield, but then you're going to have to amortize that $2,000 over a 10-year period. Basically, he's losing $200 of principal from that bond. So let's say that he's getting 6%, he's getting $600, but he's losing $200 of principal a year because that $2,000 premium he paid for will expire when the bond matures. So if he subtract $200 from the $600, he's really only getting 4%, not the 6% he thinks he's getting.
Exactly. But I think it's important to note that for someone who has a specific income requirement, they might be willing to pay that premium over par to get that higher interest rate because their income need is so high. So there are times when a person will actually take that risk and buy the bond at a premium because they really want that higher coupon rate, that higher yield on the bond.
And also, Kathleen, if you're in a period where interest rates are rising slightly, the higher yielding bonds tend to hold their value a little better because obviously the rates are higher.
Exactly. Why don't we talk a little bit about risks to bonds and how those risks are different than the risks to stocks?
Well, I mean, if you look at a bond today, there's probably four big bond risks that are associated with a bond. And that's the point I want to bring up here is there are risks to investing in bonds. There is no such thing as a risk-free investment, not even buying treasury bonds from the U.S. government. And at the top of the list of risks to a bond would be interest rate risk. Going back to the example that we started with, that 5% bond, well, if interest rates go up to 6%, that bond's value, Kathleen, may drop down to a point, let's say you're getting $500 on that bond if you bought it at par. That's a 5% interest rate. Well, let's say interest rates go up to 6%. So if I wanted to get the same level of interest on a bond, the existing bond paying 5% is going to have to drop in value to yield an equivalent of close to 6%. So that bond may have to drop down to below $9,000 level to yield the equivalent of the same amount of interest. So there's always interest rate risk. However, if you own bonds directly and you hold that bond to maturity, you will get that $10,000 back. But in the short term, you would have some market rate risk associated with rising interest rates. So that's right at the top of the list is interest rate risk. Second, associated with rising interest rates is inflation risk. So you have to think about, let's say that let's take a $10,000 bond, and let's say that we have a 3% inflation rate, and you have to take a look at what will that $10,000 buy 10 years from now if inflation goes up basically 3% a year. And that is something that all bond investors face, because if you have inflation, obviously $10,000 is not going to buy the same goods and services that it can buy today. At a 3% inflation rate, the purchasing power of that bond 10 years from now would be roughly about $7,400. So you would have lost about $2,600 in purchasing power, something that we've talked on the show here, which has happened to cash investors over the last probably 5 years. They've lost 25% of their purchasing power if you stayed in cash. 15% came from inflation, and 10% came from a drop in the value of dollar. The other thing that you always run, and this has been an issue here in California with some of the municipalities, is credit risk, meaning that whoever you loan the money to, let's say you loaned it to XYZ Corp, XYZ Corp goes under. Think of Solyndra, or think of cities like Stockton, California, or, you know, think of Greek bonds. So you always run a credit risk that the issuer that you loaned money gets into financial difficulty, and they're not going to be able to pay you back your original principal. So you have credit risk. There's actually a couple more. One is called call risk. You locked in, and let's say going back to that 5% bond that we talked about, you bought a 5% bond. You're thinking, boy, interest rates are going down. I can lock in at 5% now. You jump on and you buy that bond, but there's a call provision. So you think you locked in to 5%, but now that interest rates have dropped dramatically, the company or municipality that issued that bond refinances that bond, pays you off. You lose the 5% bond because you get your money back. Now you have to reinvest the money you got back at a lower interest rate. And that has been a real issue, just like so many people have refinanced their homes here in the last couple of years because mortgage rates have dropped. There's two other issues that you have. For example, if you're buying foreign bonds, you run the risk of currency risk. The dollar has been appreciating against other major currencies in the world, contrary to a lot of people that predicted a dollar collapse. Anytime there's a crisis, think of Cyprus recently or Japan, the dollar has rallied. And so if you own, I don't know, let's say you owned a Japanese bond or you owned a European bond, well, if the dollar goes up, the value of that bond drops in value because it's measured against the dollar and the dollar is appreciated. So you have currency risk. And then finally, you have something called liquidity risk. And that is, let's say you invest in a very, very small issue. It doesn't have a lot of buyers out there. And bonds don't trade as readily as stocks do. People that own bonds or institutions, we'll talk about that in a minute, but sometimes they're not as liquid. So you have liquidity risk. So if we sum it up, probably at the top of the list when you think of bonds, interest rate risk, inflation risk, and credit risk are probably the top three out of those six.
The second person I talked to, Jim, about bonds was someone who I think was trying to figure out the risk reward of a bond. So we just covered some of the risks that bonds involve. Those are very different risks from a stock for the most part. And he was looking at his bond portion of his allocation and asking, why isn't my bond performing like the market is performing? Why isn't my bond keeping up with inflation? And I had to share with the investor that that's not the function of a bond. You don't go into a bond looking for performance. You don't go into a bond looking for an inflation hedge. You go into a bond for other specific reasons.
Exactly. We talk about diversification, and one of the primary interests that people go into bonds, and this is something I want to point out, the vast majority of bonds are owned by large institutions. They're owned by central banks. They're owned by pension funds, endowment funds, charitable foundations. And the reason that they own those bonds is they're predictable. They match liabilities. Let's say I'm an insurance company and I'm a life insurance company, a property casualty insurance company. I know that I need a predictable source of income that I can count on that can match the potential liabilities I may have to meet in the future. Think of a pension plan that has to put money aside like CalPERS for retiring state employees or teachers. They know that every year they have to put money aside and have to earn a certain rate of return so that when employees retire, they know they're going to have the money there to provide for that pension income that, let's say, the pensioners are entitled to. So, number one, people go into bonds for income. They go into bonds for safety because the return of principal. I can go into stock and I can't predict that 10 years from now, I will get 100% of the money I put into the stock. What if you put money in the stock market in 2002 and you were retiring in 2008, right in the middle of the credit crisis? Or you put money into the stock market in 1990 and you retired between 2000 and 2002 when we had a bear market. So safety of principal, income, liquidity, and also diversification. Because there are a lot of times in the last week when we got a little bit of a correction in the stock market, guess what? Bonds went up in value. And so it's a non-correlated asset to the stock market. So, for example, if we go back to the bear market of 2007 and 2009, well, if you were in stocks, your stocks lost a lot of money during that period of time, depending on what kind of stocks you own. If you were in blue chip dividend paying stocks, you probably did a lot better. Or if you were in predictable, safer stocks like utilities, consumer staples, or healthcare, you did much better. But if you were in bonds during that period of time, you actually made money. Your bonds appreciated in value as the Fed lowered interest rates and brought interest rates down. So bonds are a non-correlated asset, and they're sort of a hedge. If you think of alternate scenarios, whether you're in the gloom and doom camp or you're in the Armageddon camp, well, you know, one thing is cash and bonds are sort of a market hedge against a market downturn, just like between 2000 and 2002. If you were in bonds, your bonds went up in value. If you were in bonds in 2007 and 2009, when we went through that bear market, you made money in your bonds. They were a hedge against a market downturn, just like gold, stocks, and commodities are an inflation hedge. So there are different asset classes, and they're there for different reasons. And it's only through diversification where you have some money in stocks, you have some money in cash, you have some money in bonds. So if one market goes into a bear market like stocks between 2007 and 2009 or 2000 and 2002, if you had money in bonds, Well, you know what? You protected yourself because you did very well. You got your interest, and your bonds actually appreciated as the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates. So there are a number of reasons to be in bonds.
Another function for bonds, Jim, in addition to providing some diversification, safety, and income, is for planned liquidity. What do I mean by planned liquidity? When I say planned liquidity, I mean I know that 7 years from now, my oldest daughter is going to be applying to school. She's going to be going to a private school. I anticipate that private school to cost $40,000 a year in tuition. So I purchase a bond now that comes due her first year of college for $40,000. Then I purchase another bond for her second year in school, another bond for her third year of school, etc. So that her first year of school, I get the face value of the bond, comes back into my portfolio, I have those funds readily available to pay off tuition. We have several clients who funded their kids' education this way. Last week, Jim, you also talked to Wade Fow about the 4% withdrawal rule. And you and he were talking about the role of immediate annuities in producing dependable income. And you and he also discussed the role of individual bonds in producing dependable income.
We've often talked here on the program, Kathleen, about predictability. When you're planning for retirement, we've often talked about having a plan, which means, okay, I'm going to have a budget. And let's say, for illustration's sake, that your retirement budget is, if you're living in California, let's just make this simple and just say it's $90,000 a year. That's what it costs to make your payments, live, pay your taxes, pay your insurance premiums, buy food. Let's say that's $90,000. Let's say that your wish for list or your bucket list, you know, you'd like to take a trip a year, maybe join a country club, that's $10,000. So your basic living expenses are $90,000. Well, one of the things you want to do when you're planning for retirement, you want to take a look at all sources of income that you have that are predictable. In other words, you can count on them. So you might start out with looking at Social Security, and you can say, all right, I know that I'm going to be getting $3,000 a month in Social Security. My monthly expenses are $8,000, so I can subtract $3,000 from the $8,000 I spend a month. That leaves $5,000. Let's say you have a pension from work, or let's say you work for the government, you have a pension that's paying you, let's say, another $3,000. So you know between your pension and Social Security, you have predictable income of $6,000. However, your monthly expenses are $8,000. So you have a shortfall of $2,000. Now, let's say that you have a portfolio. One of the things that you would want to do is, this is where bonds come into play, and that's why Professor Fow was talking about laddered bonds versus a bond fund, because bond funds have reduced their income over the last 10 years. So you don't want to say that I'm going to put my money all in a bond fund when the income isn't predictable. It can change. It can be reduced, which is what has happened over the last 10 years. So if you go into, let's say, a laddered bond portfolio and you're getting 4 or 5%, I go back to that example of the $10,000 bond. Let's change that just for illustration purposes. And let's say that you put $250,000 of a portfolio into bonds at 5%. You would be making enough money to make up the shortfall that you have meeting your monthly needs. And that's why bonds are often used frequently. You see a high concentration of bonds in company pension plans because they're predictable. The pension managers know that what the interest is going to be. They use laddered bond portfolios. That's why the largest owners of bonds in this country are pension funds, endowment funds, foundations, because they know they can get predictable income that they can count on. And that's really the role that annuities, or in this case, we're talking bonds today, play in a retirement plan. Because, okay, I know if I have a 5% bond, it matures in 10 years, I know I'm going to get 5% each year. I can count on that $500 coming in. I can't do that if I keep my money in a bank CD or a money market fund where the interest rates are always changing, or even in the stock market, even though I believe blue chip stocks are a good combination, and that's what Professor Fow recommended as the best retirement combination, either laddered bonds and annuities combined with blue chip type stocks. But that's the role that bonds play in a retirement plan, is providing that predictability, providing that liquidity, and providing that safety to the retiree so they don't have to guess that, okay, I know that I've got my basic living needs met. I don't have to guess. I don't have to worry if the stock market corrects and is down 10% this year, or, for example, between 2007 and 2009 when stocks lost 40% of their value.
Outside of retirement planning, Jim, I think, again, this goes back to the conversation that we had a few weeks ago about doomsday prepper portfolios. We were talking about the role of different asset classes if various scenarios were to occur. And we shared with our listeners at that point in time that cash and bonds are your market crash hedge, just like gold, stocks, and commodities are your inflation or your dollar hedge. So again, the role of a bond is very different from a stock. You really shouldn't be looking at, quote unquote, the performance of your bond in terms of its value. Obviously, if there's a change in its credit rating, that's something to be worried about. But bond valuations will fluctuate until you actually get the principal back at maturity. So again, looking at a bond in your portfolio, you're looking at it and its role in your portfolio very differently from a stock. You're not really looking at performance so much as you are creditworthiness, dependable income, and stability. So that's the reasons why you're looking at a bond in your portfolio.
And the reason that we always recommend diversification, Kathleen, is that there's no perfect investment. And this is one of the biggest faults that we see with investors today is they put all their eggs in one basket. If you're in the doomsday camp, you might be all in cash and gold, and you know gold has not performed well over the last 3 years, nor have gold stocks. Cash has been a horrible investment the last 6 years because you've gotten nothing on it. So the nice thing about diversification, and the reason for it, is there is no perfect investment. There is no investment that is going to give you, for example, an inflation hedge, a hedge against currencies, liquidity. But through diversification, through, you know, investing in blue chip stocks, having some in cash, maybe having some in gold, and having some in bonds, then you've got safety, you've got income, you've got liquidity. And no major portion of your portfolio is subject to all the risk of either a market crash or, let's say, inflation risk. You just can't find one investment that provides all those benefits. I mean, I like gold. I'm a believer in gold, and I think people should invest in it. It's a currency hedge. It's a doomsday hedge. You know, the thing about gold, it's nobody else's liability. But, you know, the thing about gold is it doesn't produce any income. So if I'm retired or nearing retirement or planning for retirement in a pension plan, you know, having some money in gold makes some sense. But once again, gold is not going to give me a monthly check. It's not going to provide me income. It's not going to pay my bills unless I sell it. And how would you like to be selling gold over the last couple of years when gold has been going down? There is no perfect investment. It's the reason you diversify. Bonds provide against a different risk. They provide different benefits that you get in stocks or commodities such as gold.
So Jim and I have been discussing the concept of an overall diversified portfolio. And some people in the industry refer to this as portfolio efficiency, about planning for these different types of risk and using different asset classes to address those different types of risk. So speaking of efficiency, Jim, coming up next on the show is your interview with Tom Collette of The Standard, and he's going to be discussing tax-efficient business planning with you.
And since it is tax time, and you're probably listening to this on the day you filed your tax return, you're going to want to listen to this, especially either if you're an employee, have not considered contributing to the company's 401k plan, or you're self-employed and a business person. We're going to be talking about efficient ways to get nice tax deductions with all kinds of flexibility that you can design to specifically meet either the needs of your business or the objectives you have in planning for your retirement. That's coming up next with Tom Collette right after this. Joining me on the program today is Tom Collette. He's senior attorney with Standard Retirement Services. And Tom, we're doing this interview on a Thursday. Next week is April 15th. And what I wanted to do is have you on the program and talk about tax-efficient business planning as it relates to retirement plans for small businesses. So let's begin with that. The trouble I think a lot of businesses have today, there's so many plans out there. You have IRAs, you have simple IRAs, you have profit sharing, SEP IRAs, defined benefit plans, combo plans. So let's talk about making the right choices for a business.
All right. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the program today. There are quite a few different types of plans out there that the government permits contributions to. The contributions that are made to plans are normally tax deductible, and the employer can get a tax deduction for any contributions that the employer makes to the plan. There are a number of IRAs, as you mentioned. The two most prevalent ones that we have seen are the Simple IRA and the Simplified Employee Pension, which is also funded through IRAs. And those require a little bit smaller amounts of contribution, but do provide good benefits to employees, or can provide good benefits to employees. The Simple IRA permits both employer and employee contributions, and the Simplified Employee Pension IRA provides just employer contributions. If you want to go beyond those types of contributions that are permitted in the IRAs, then you can get into the qualified plans. And as you mentioned, there are profit-sharing plans, there's 401k plans, there's defined benefit plans. And all of these have different limits and different contributions. Some permit employee contributions, some do not. But there are a number of different options out there that employers can elect to use and get tax deductions for the contributions to the plan and accumulate a sizable sum for retirement.
Tomka, let's stay on IRAs for a moment. Can you explain, from an employer perspective, the advantages of a Simple IRA or a SEP IRA versus, let's say, the typical program that most people are familiar with, which is, for example, the 401k program?
Sure. The Simple IRA is set up where both employees and employer can contribute to the plan. The employees generally can defer from their compensation up to $12,000 for 2013. If they happen to be over the age of 50, or at least attain age 50 by the end of 2013, they're also eligible to make a catch-up contribution, which for 2013 is $2,500. So an individual who is 50 or over by the end of 2013 could make a contribution to the Simple IRA of $14,500. Under the Simple IRA, the employer also is required to make a contribution, and that contribution is either 2% of compensation, or they can make a matching contribution, which would only be made for those employees who decide to make a contribution to the plan. And that matching contribution is dollar for dollar up to 3% of compensation. So if someone puts in 3% of compensation or more, the employer needs to put in 3% of compensation for them. If they put in less, they put in the same percentage of compensation as the employee contributed. With the SEP IRA, this only permits employer contributions, but these contributions can be fairly sizable because there is a limit of 25% of compensation. It's a discretionary type contribution, so each year the employer can decide how much they want to contribute to the plan, and they don't have to contribute in years where funds might be tight. But all of these contributions are permitted on a tax-deductible basis.
But Tom, what's the upward limit on a SEP IRA?
On a SEP IRA, you're allowed to go up to 25% of compensation, and the maximum amount is under the 415 limits, which is $51,000 an individual could have allocated to their account.
Wow, that's a sizable deductible. Now, when you're talking about a SEP IRA or a Simple IRA, is one of the reasons that these are often used in small businesses because they're easy to administer, they're not complicated? Because I know you start getting into a 401k program, you have a lot more rules, you have to have a trustee administer. Is that one of the reasons why these kind of plans have become so popular?
I think that is. There is really very little governmental involvement in these types of plans. They were set up to not require any filings with the IRS like you would have with a qualified plan. You have to be either a bank, an insurance company, a mutual fund company, or some other type of financial institution that has been approved by the IRS in order to sponsor an IRA. And so these institutions are familiar with the IRA rules and can do a good job of setting up the plan for employers and actually monitoring them.
So let's take a business, a small business or a business that has a lot more employees. Let's talk about which one would be the most tax efficient for a business. In other words, a 401k versus, let's say, a Simple or SEP IRA.
I think that the answer to that question may depend on the objectives of the employer. If the objective of the employer is to benefit the key people, then I think maybe a qualified plan is going to be a better approach because you can skew contributions a little bit more in favor of the owners in a lot of situations with a qualified plan. If the motivation is just to benefit employees, then both types are going to be good, but you do have a little more flexibility as far as the provisions of the plan and who to include in the qualified plan versus who might have to be included in the SEP plan.
Let's kind of bring this home and take two examples. Let's say I'm in the first case, I'm Larry Lotsabots. I'm a one percenter. You know, the business is doing well. Maybe I'm making upper six figures. You know, outside a house mortgage, I really could use a tax deduction because I'm, you know, maybe 10 years, 15 years away from retirement. That's case number one. We got Larry lots of bucks. And let's take this second case, and we'll call them Joe Average, where, you know, the business is doing well, but maybe I'm making $150,000, $200,000 a year. I'm not like Larry lots of bucks. I'd like to put some money aside for retirement. Under those two different circumstances, which type of plan would make the most sense? Let's take Larry lots of bucks first.
Well, since Larry has a lot of money available and is probably interested in making larger contributions for himself, I think probably going to the qualified plan route may make the most sense. You indicated that he's probably within 10 or 15 years of retirement, and there are provisions that are permitted in a qualified plan, whether it be just a profit-sharing plan or a 401k plan, that will permit the contributions to be skewed more in favor of the highly compensated employees. There's what they call cross-tested type plans, where if the owners and the highly compensated employees are a little bit older than the rank and file employees, the IRS permits a little bit larger contributions for those employees. And so in that type of situation, Larry could potentially sock away up to the $51,000 limit and not have to put away the same percentage and same dollar amounts as for the other employees as he would for himself. With regard to the other situation where you've got an individual who's not working or not earning as much as Larry, so doesn't have quite so many funds available, I think either the simplified employee pension or the simple IRA approach may make some sense. With the simple IRA approach, the employees get to actually make contributions to the plan, so he could actually make contributions up to $14,500 for himself. The employer is going to be required to put in either a 2% contribution or that matching contribution, dollar for dollar, up to 3% of compensation. But he'll be able to put away the $14,500 for himself, and then the company would get a tax deduction for the contributions that it would make to the simple IRA from the employer point of view. The SEP IRA is also an option if he wants to make the same type percentage contribution for all employees. And there is a method of allocating in the SEP that permits you to actually, what I call, discriminate in favor of the highly compensated employees on a legal basis, because the IRS permits you to, what they call, integrate with Social Security or use permitted disparity in the allocation. And basically what that's doing is permitting you to favor the highly compensated employee a little bit more than the rank and file employee.
Let's talk about maybe some combination plans where you do have older employees, and let's say you have highly compensated employees up at the top. What about combinations? I know at one time, at least when I got in this business and I began my career in the 80s, defined benefit plans were very popular. We had athletes, we had doctors, and defined benefit contributions allowed for some great tax deductions where you could fund, I think it was back a couple hundred thousand. I think the limit today is $250,000. Let's talk about the defined benefit type of pension plan, which you see a lot at the government level. In other words, if you're a federal worker, you work for the state, you work for a municipality, where they come in and say, all right, with X amount of years of service, you're going to retire with 80% of your salary or 90%. Let's talk about defined benefit plans and where are they most applicable today? Where do they fit in? And then also some comments, why did big companies do away with them?
That's a good question with respect to defined benefit plans. In the 70s and 80s, they were very popular, and that popularity really went away when the IRS came in and started putting some limitations on what could be provided in defined benefit plans. But they still have their place and can be a very good financial planning tool to use in the right situation. We see them a lot of times in small to medium-sized employer situations, but a defined benefit plan permits an employer to actually fund for a specific benefit at retirement. And currently, the defined benefit plans permit a benefit of up to $205,000 as an annual benefit. And the contribution that's required to fund those benefits isn't really limited other than by the fact that they need to contribute whatever funds are needed to provide that benefit. And if that happens to be $200,000 a year, that's the contribution that can go into the plan. One of the drawbacks of that type of plan is that there are those required contributions, and those have to be made to the plan. And if the employer has some up years and down years, even in the down years, these contributions are likely going to have to be made to the plan. So that can cause a financial burden in those kind of situations. But if the employer has a very good system in place where they've got quite a few dollars available to fund for such a plan, this is a great opportunity to suck away a lot of contributions into a plan for retirement.
You know, we have used them in a situation where last year with the hike in California taxes, we had a small IT consulting firm, basically husband and wife with three or four employees making seven figures a year, with a lot of their employees were independent contractors. So based on the jobs they'd take on, they would contract a lot of the work out. So this fit very nicely because this couple was less than a decade away from retirement. And with the husband and wife being the older employees, the other employees being younger, this fit very nicely from a tax planning point of view.
I think those are great situations. We've seen a number of those also. And I didn't mean to sound a little bit doom and gloom with the required contributions, because even if you run into a situation when you have a defined benefit plan where the funds are a little bit tight, there are certain things that you can do. You can freeze benefits for a year or two, or reduce the benefit formula, that type of thing. So there is some flexibility involved in those contributions, but I think it needs to be kept in mind that those contributions are normally going to be required every year. But it can be a great planning tool. We've seen a number of people accumulate quite a bit of retirement dollars in a short period of time with the use of the defined benefit plan.
Tom, what about combination plans? Let's say that I want some flexibility as an employer, that this has been a tough recession that we've worked our way out of. We haven't seen a recession this deep. Things are on the mend. Housing strong, autos are strong. It sounds like the economy is picking up a little bit. At least things are looking better. So with that in mind, I'm an employer that says, you know what? We're coming out of the recession. Our sales are going up. But I remember what 2007 and 2009 was like. I'd like to take advantage of a pension plan while things are going well, contribute money and salt it away and get the tax deduction. But maybe we go back into another recession. I want some flexibility. Well, what kind of ideas or what kind of options are available that provide that flexibility?
I think that you can have actually a combination of a defined benefit plan, which might provide somewhat of a base benefit for employees that the employer feels comfortable that they can afford, and then also have a profit-sharing type plan on top of that, so that you have some flexibility in a profit-sharing plan. Because with a profit-sharing plan, your contributions are normally discretionary, and so you can have years where you could put in close to 25% of compensation in the plan, and then other years where you don't have to put in anything. But if you have both a defined benefit plan, which is going to provide that basic benefit for people, and then and have a fixed contribution in a sense for the employer, and then have the flexibility to make additional contributions in good years, that might work out very well for them.
What about, have you ever seen something like, let's say, a defined benefit combined with a 401k plan?
Yes, they aren't as frequent as they used to be because, as you mentioned earlier, the trend has been away from defined benefit plans, but it is permissible to have both a defined benefit plan and a 401k plan at the same time so that the employees can contribute their own funds to the plan and also participate in the defined benefit plan, and then that there is the flexibility for the employer to make a contribution under that profit-sharing or 401k plan each year.
Tom, if you were sitting and giving advice to a business, what are some of the first steps that, let's say, a business owner should consider? Sometimes you just get what I call standard advice. Oh, you want to set up a 401k program. You want to set up a simple IRA. What are the steps that you would take a client through before you'd make a recommendation? I would imagine taking a look at the goals of the employer, how many years away they are from retirement, the predictability of the income of the corporation or business. I mean, could you give us sort of hands-on, you know, this is step one, two, three, four, that one should consider before, let's say, rushing into a retirement plan?
Sure. I think you've mentioned most of the main steps. I think the first initial step is going to be, what are the objectives of the employer? Are they interested in benefiting themselves mainly, or do they want to take a more of a paternalistic approach and benefit the employees just as well as the business owner? That's going to help decide what type of plan might be better. The second objective would seem to be the budget. If the business owner has a large budget, that might lead them towards a different type of retirement plan. The budget would include both the contributions that the employer would make to the plan as well as any contribution or costs, let's say, that are associated with the administration of any of these types of plans. Generally, the more you can put into a plan, the more the government is looking at the plan itself, and therefore the more costly the administration is going to be.
Would it also depend on the type of employees you have in terms of whether they're young versus the owners being old? Or let's say if you have some employees that are just making minimum wage and, you know, they're living hand to mouth. I imagine putting a 401k program where people don't have the excess income to put into 401k would not make sense. So does the income of the employees also factor in?
I do think the income of the employees factors in. It might not make sense, like you say, to have a 401k plan where the employees are really not going to be able to contribute. If you do have a situation where the employer is interested in making contributions to the plan and permitting the employees to make contributions to the plan, you could set up what they call a safe harbor 401k plan. And in that instance, the employer might have to make a contribution for those employees who contribute, but still could make sizable 401k contributions for themselves. But for the most part, setting up a plan for employees or in situations where the employees are sort of living paycheck to paycheck is going to be difficult when the plan permits contributions for them and they're not going to take advantage of that. One other item that you mentioned I think that is key is the age of the business owner, because that can affect how much can be put into a plan. So we look at the age of the business owner compared to the other employees. The budget, the objectives of the employer, the number of employees in the business. One thing I didn't mention with respect to the simple IRA is you can't have more than 100 employees eligible for the plan. So that might, you know, if you have more than 100 employees, that would knock out the ability to use a simple IRA.
Tom, what about the government? Since I've been in this business, they're always changing depending on the administration. You just had President Obama yesterday with his budget proposals talking about limiting pension plans for upper income individuals to $3 million a year. What about putting in a plan where, you know, you think, all right, I'm going to go through the expense, put this plan into place, I'm going to pay for the administration, and then all of a sudden what happens is you get a new administration come in and they change the rules.
I think that's a real concern. Fortunately, they haven't made any real big changes over the years other than cutting back on limitations on contributions, which they did back in the 80s, which was had a detrimental effect on retirement plans at that point. But since then, they've continued to move up the contributions that are permitted. But it is difficult with the government situation when the administration changes and they actually change benefits, that type of thing. You're seeing a trend now, I think, away from defined benefit plans, at least in local governments, because the local governments are finally realizing that these defined benefit plans that have been provided for governmental employees are very difficult to pay for, and that they're going to take a huge portion of the city's budget to pay for those. So I think there is a little bit of a trend away from that, going somewhat towards the 401k type plan.
And do you think we're more likely to see that in the future? I have contended that, you know, you take a look at these unfunded liabilities, like, for example, my own state of California that has over $200 billion. I mean, state residents aren't going to sit there and pay huge amount of taxes so that people that work for government can have benefits that nobody in the private sector gets. I mean, I don't know very many companies today that are giving their employees 80, 90%, or in some cases here, 100% of their salary when they retire.
I think that's true. I think that trend will be away from the defined benefit plans. I know a lot of them I've seen are talking about instituting a 401k type plan for new employees, and the problems they're having is trying to fund the benefits for the current employees or the employees who are already retired. So I think the trend will be away from those types of plans in the governmental agencies.
So are we more likely to see things like defined benefits will still be around, but maybe they're the small husband and wife, the athlete, the movie star, those kind of people that have those kind of plans where, you know, they don't have the administration or the numerous employees to fund, where you see maybe, or things like the SEP IRA, the simple IRA, the 401k, or maybe some kind of combination plan, more of what we're likely to see going forward?
Yeah, I think that we'll see the defined benefit plan for the small employer situations, and actually some of the large, real large employers still have their defined benefit plans. But I think in the groups in between, you're not going to see as many defined benefit plans. There's been a very substantial decline in defined benefit plans in that area because employers don't have the money to fund for those plans, and they need the money to fund their business. So I think the smaller plans, particularly the 401k type plan, I think is a very good plan for a lot of small to medium-sized employers. We've found that, or there have been studies that have shown that if the employer has a plan that the employee can contribute to, they are more likely to take advantage of that than just go out and contribute to their own IRA. So even the simple IRA or the SEP IRA, those can be decent plans that can help provide benefits for retirement for employees.
And aren't they more likely to see employees contribute, especially if there's some matching contributions coming from the employer? So not only does the employee get a tax deduction and shelter part of their income. I mean, most employees, Tom, as you are well aware, I mean, you know, their basic deductions are exemptions for themselves, their kids, the home mortgage deduction, any charitable contributions, and state taxes. That's it. So for employees, one of the best tax deductions outside their home in state taxes has been a pension, and they're more likely to contribute to one if they're getting employer matching contributions.
Yes, an employer matching contribution is a great incentive for employees to contribute to the plan. If you think of it in terms of maybe a matching contribution of dollar for dollar up to 3% of compensation or something like that, that's a 100% return on your investment. So if you put in a dollar, the employer's going to put in a dollar for you, and that's before you actually have any of the funds invested. And even if it's a contribution like 50 cents on the dollar up to 6% of compensation, that's a 50% return on your money, and I don't know where else you can get a return on your money that is in that range. So I think that's a great incentive, and if employers have a matching contribution, hopefully they can explain to the employees that you need to at least contribute the maximum amount necessary to get the maximum matching contribution.
Tom, what is the best time to do the kind of planning? I mean, right now, next week, people have to file their tax returns, so everybody is really thinking about taxes this time of the year. It usually happens that way from January to April. But, you know, it would seem to me if you're having a good year, your business is doing well, the time to plan is, you know, don't do it when it's too late. Do it sometime during the year, maybe the middle of the summer when you've got a good look at, you know, maybe what the first half of the year is like. You have a better feeling for the second half of the year. And do so in advance so you have plenty of time to look at all your options and thoroughly think through what those deductions and tax savings are going to be, the administration and the cost. Seems to me that doing some upfront planning well in advance before the year ends or at tax time makes a lot of sense.
I think it does make a lot of sense. It does take a little while to get these types of plans designed as well as installed. And if you're going to have a 401k type plan, you've got to be sure that you can take care of your all the deductions through your payroll system. So there is a lot of planning that's involved. So I do think it's a good idea to start as early as you can in the year making that planning, especially with the 401k type situation. Employees will have the ability to defer from their compensation. The longer you wait, the shorter period of time they're going to have to defer for the year, and so the smaller contributions that we made for the year. But the sooner you start, the larger the amount of time and the larger amount of contributions that can be put into the plan. You know, the one plan that you have some time after the end of a plan year to establish is the simplified employee pension, because you are allowed to establish that up until the time for filing your tax return. So you only have a couple days left here, but for 2012, a simplified employee pension plan could be still installed, but it has to be installed by April 15th for those taxpayers who are on an April 15th deadline.
Well, Tom, this program is going to be aired on April 15th. So for those listening, if do they have to the end of the day to do that?
I think they do. And the challenge might be to find an institution that can set it up until before the end of the day, and they'd have to make their contributions also before they file their income tax return. So that could be a real challenge.
Do you have the option with those kind of plans to maybe, let's say you're filing an extension? Does the setup go along with the extension?
You know, Jim, I'm not sure if the setup on those types of plans goes along with the extension. I know that the filing of the, or the making of the contribution will go along with the extension, but I don't know if you're allowed to extend setting up a simplified employee pension beyond your tax filing deadline.
All right. Well, listen, Tom, I appreciate you coming on the program. If our listeners would like to talk to your organization for setting up a retirement plan, how could they do so?
What they could do is actually visit our website, which is www.standard.com, or they can talk to their professional financial advisor. Standard works exclusively with financial advisors, and they can connect you and provide you with more information.
Well, we've been speaking with Tom Collette. He heads up a senior attorney with the Standard Retirement Services, and we've been talking about tax-efficient business planning. And remember, the best way to plan is plan in advance or have a plan. And we would urge you, if you're in a situation where you're fortunate enough where you can put some money aside, you know what? You're filing your tax return now. Now might be a good time to start planning for 2013. Tom, I want to thank you for joining us on the program.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, that concludes our interview with Tom Collette. And if there's any advice I'd like to give you is, if you're listening to this program, you're listening to it on April 15th. If you're thinking about tax planning, well, you just filed your tax return. Now's the time to start thinking about this. You might want to sit down with your financial advisor, sit down, take a look at your income, maybe reassess what your objectives are, and come up with a plan that best suits what your needs and objectives are for planning for your retirement. And if you can do so on a tax-efficient basis, remember, the money you put into the retirement plan, you get a tax deduction for it. That means you save Social Security taxes, you save income taxes, you save state taxes, so you get a tax deduction. It's a nice way to reduce your taxes, so in essence, depending on your bracket, a good portion of that plan is being funded by the government through tax savings. And more importantly, while that money is invested in your plan, that money grows and compounds tax deferred. So you're not having to pay taxes on dividends or on interest, whatever your objectives are. And, of course, the more that you can compound over a longer period of time without paying your favorite uncle or governor, the more you're going to have for yourself when you get ready to retire. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, would like to thank you for tuning in to Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.